This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, why private equity is everywhere. Back in 2019, Megan Greenwell had her dream job. She was the editor of Deadspin, an online sports, politics, and culture news outlet, and the site was thriving.
We were doing well traffic-wise with this deeply loyal audience. We were profitable. It was going great.
Deadspin was owned by Univision, but when the site got acquired by a small Boston private equity firm, the change was swift.
It was just clear pretty immediately that they didn't really care what was making us successful. They had no curiosity about what actually worked and what didn't.
Ultimately, Megan's differences with the new management led her to leave within 3 months of the acquisition. It was that experience of seeing firsthand how quickly private equity can completely change a company that made her wonder how private equity works in other sectors. Places like hospitals, retail stores, and housing. Businesses that serve real basic needs and often operate on or close to the margins.
Private equity guys sell themselves as these sort of swashbuckling heroes who are willing to take the risks nobody else will take to save these companies. It's almost like a heroic thing, even though they are also making gazillions of dollars off of it. And the truth of the matter is, the more you read, the more you realize there's no risk for them at all.
In a new book, Bad Company, Private Equity, and the Death of the American Dream, Megan breaks down how private equity firms are reshaping our lives and tells the story of some of the people pushing back against these entities for the sake of their jobs, their families, and their communities. When I sat down with Megan, we started by talking about what exactly private equity is and how it works.
Private equity is a system of capital that pools money from outside investors and loans. So it combines those two sources of capital. Generally, when people talk about private equity, and what I mean when I talk about private equity in the book, is leveraged buyouts, which are the engine of the private equity machine. And leveraged buyouts are essentially you pool money from those two sources and you buy a company outright. So it differs from, say, venture capital, where you're investing in a company for an ownership stake. This is you own it outright. And it's this combination of pension money, money from individual investors, banks, and also huge loans. And those loans are taken out not in the name of the private equity firm, but in the name of the company they are acquiring, which means that if that company goes bankrupt or has to liquidate, the private equity firm is not responsible for paying that money back. Only the company itself is required to pay it back. And so the private equity firm has all of these financialization tricks that allow it to make money off of the company it owns. But because of this structure where they're not responsible for the loans, they don't need to make the company succeed for them to succeed.
In fact, it sounds like they could still stand to gain by having the company fail, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the incentives of a private equity firm and the incentives of the company they acquire are not necessarily the same. They can be, but if they are, it's almost more accidental than it is deliberate. So the basic structure of private equity payments when they acquire a company is called 2 and 20. So they make 2% of the cost of the company as an annual management fee, no matter what else happens. 20% of all profits go to them. So if the company is not profitable, obviously they won't make money that way. But there are still all of these tricks they use, tax loopholes, selling off the real estate. And many of these tricks actually put the company in danger while lining the private equity firm's pockets. Hmm. And I think it's a dangerous system when those incentives get split in that way, where they don't actually feel the need to make the company successful to make millions and millions of dollars for themselves.
Hmm. So you've described leveraged buyouts in which the private equity firms don't have to assume any risk, right? Is this ever a good thing for the company and its employees?
Yeah, it certainly is. There are many, many, many cases of especially like small family-owned companies that really want to grow for one reason or another, might not have the capital to do it. And so a private equity firm will come in, give them the capital to do it, and actually invest in a strategic way. That is often happening in growth industries. The bigger leveraged buyouts from the bigger private equity firms and the bigger deals tend to be in more struggling industries. So the ones I write about in the book are retail, housing, healthcare, and local journalism, all of which have real challenges with their business model. It's just much, much harder to make the private equity model work in those industries, even though those are the industries that private equity claims they're the superheroes swooping in to save them. And a huge percentage of companies acquired by private equity struggle much worse after the acquisition than they did before. And so just objectively, this is not a system that is working. Even before you get to the human costs of the layoffs, the stripped services, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, Megan, I did a little news headline search of the word private equity. I was just curious to see what kinds of headlines come up. And I mean, you get a lot of results that are like, why your local vet is owned by private equity?
Yeah.
And why is it killing everything that you love?
Yes.
Getting a lot of headlines like that. But maybe most infamously, you get explainers on how private equity killed Toys R Us. And I know that in the book, you follow someone who was affected by the Toys R Us downfall, someone who worked there. Her name is Liz. Can you tell us what was going well for Liz when she first started working at Toys R Us? And when did things start to change?
Yeah, Liz is just a firecracker of a character. I followed her for about 2 years, and she's so fun to talk to and so clear-eyed about everything. Liz is an Alaskan native. She had lived her entire life in Alaska, but her husband wanted to go to pharmacy school. And there were, at the time, zero pharmacy schools in the state of Alaska. So they knew they were going to have to move to the mainland. They moved to the Pacific Northwest. Liz knew she needed a job that would support their family of five by herself. And she had a great career at Toys R Us. She rose up the ranks pretty quickly. She was supporting her family of five on what objectively was a really low salary, but she was making it work. And she was consistently a very high-performing employee. And so this was a person who, until Toys R Us fell apart for reasons so far above her pay grade, was a huge asset to this company, and this company was the thing allowing her to support her family.
And just to be clear, she started working for Toys R Us years after it had already been acquired by the private equity firms KKR and Bain Capital, right?
That's right. She started working there in 2012, and KKR and Bain Capital and Vornado Realty Trust had bought Toys R Us in 2005.
By the way, I just want to mention, Vornado actually owns the building where the Apple New York offices are, just to say.
There you go. And Vornado is not a private equity firm, but works very closely with a lot of private equity firms, in part because selling the real estate of a company acquired by private equity is a super profitable tactic. And so partnering with somebody like Vornado, which is one of the biggest real estate companies in the country, makes a lot of sense.
I see.
So when KKR, Bain Capital, and Vornado bought Toys R Us, they took out more than $5 billion in loans out of a slightly over $6 billion deal. So they loaded Toys R Us down with so many loans, and they sold the land out from under many, many, many of the Toys R Us stores in the United States. And then Toys R Us had to pay rent on all of these stores they formerly owned. And many of them they had owned for decades. And so they weren't paying mortgage payments at that point. They had them free and clear. So now you're adding rent payments to the books. And the conventional wisdom narrative about what doomed Toys R Us is the rise of Amazon, right? Like, so much retail, there was just no way to make it work when Amazon came around.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is obviously some truth to the idea that Amazon made it much, much more difficult for retail. But there are a lot of specialty realtors that continue to exist and continue to do well and show a path that could have been open to Toys R Us if they had the money to be creative, right? So you think about a store like Sephora, which has continued to do really well. They did really well by continuing to focus on the in-store experience. And a lot of folks thought that was where Toys R Us needed to go, but there was no money to do that. Liz was looking around her store outside of Portland, Oregon, and saying, there are just basic things that could be improved that I know are turning off our customers. But because so much of the money was eaten up in interest payments, in rent payments, all of these things, there was just no money to do it.
Why was that the more profitable route for these PE firms than doubling down on shoring up Toys R Us as its own category-specific company?
Yeah. So shoring up the fundamentals of a business is long, slow, hard work. And the model of private equity is exactly the opposite. The average lifespan of a company under private equity ownership is 5 to 7 years. So there's not usually time to really build the business in a super methodical way. That is just not something that can happen overnight. Whereas collecting the rent payments and taking the dividends and taking your management fees, they got bonuses many years, even though the company, by most measures, was not doing well. Those were all good ways to make money. Could they have made more by shoring up the fundamentals of the business? Maybe, but that would have taken many more years.
So when Toys R Us eventually filed for bankruptcy in 2017, they closed their last store in the U.S. in 2021. And as you mentioned, it did really hurt the employees, right? Even though they had severance package spelled out in their contracts, some 33,000 workers were terminated and not given any severance. So this is another part of the story where Liz really steps in and steps up in a big way and finds her voice. Tell us a little bit about how she worked with others and organized.
Yeah, I mean, this was so interesting to me because these were rank and file retail workers who didn't have a lot of privilege, really needed to get back to work in most cases because they were supporting their families, got laid off without severance because it wasn't a priority in the bankruptcy deal. And they said, you know what? We're not going to take this. And they organized in several ways. They would stage protests outside of KKR and Bain Capital offices. Would they ever get anywhere in terms of getting to meet with anybody? No, but they got a bunch of headlines out of it, and that counted for a lot. And then they did something that was really smart, I think. They started appearing in front of pension boards. So public pension funds are a huge source of capital for private equity firms. And those public pension boards have public meetings, and they often have employee representatives. So if your public pension fund pays the retirement funds of teachers, firefighters, nurses, people like that, those people will have a seat or two on the board. And the Toys R Us workers realize that those types of folks were likely to be much more sympathetic to their cause. So they started showing up at these meetings, registering to speak during the public comment portion, and giving these really powerful testimonies about how their lives had been affected by Toys R Us going under. And it really worked. One pension fund actually temporarily stopped all investments into KKR. And eventually, all of this pressure added up such that Bain and KKR felt obligated to create, they wouldn't call it a severance fund because they wanted to emphasize that they didn't owe anybody anything, but they called it a hardship fund, and they ended up paying all of the workers.
Oh, wow. And what did they get out of it specifically?
Not as much as they were supposed to get, unfortunately. Liz got about $6,000, which was well less than she would have been guaranteed as real severance because she had worked there for so long. But it was a lot better than nothing.
Let's talk about this pension fund aspect of it, because you hear PE firms talk about this, right? That they help pensioners in this way, but there's a cost to that as well. Can you say more about the relationship between how these investments go toward public pension funds?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the most interesting components to me. So it really is a massive amount of money that comes into private equity funds from pension funds. And every pension fund in the country is invested in private equity. And often you will see headlines that one of the big pension funds is going to put more into private equity, because the research on this is controversial, but many people believe that private equity funds have higher rates of return. And if your pension fund is underfunded, which many of them are, that's a good way, in their estimation, to sort of gin up a little more money. I had this really interesting interview with the co-head of global private equity at KKR in the fall of 2023. They had just bought Simon & Schuster, the book publisher. And publishing is an industry that's very famous for low salaries. People will be making $30,000 trying to live in New York City. And I said to him, okay, Simon & Schuster now has this very wealthy owner. Are you going to raise salaries? And he said, no, I can't raise salaries because this is not my money. This is the money of all of those firefighters and nurses and teachers who need a retirement plan. And that was so interesting to me. There's a labor journalist named Hamilton Nolan who wrote about my interview, and he termed this philosophy capitalism's washing machine, which was a phrase I really liked, because essentially he's saying, this is a zero-sum game. I have to benefit this group of middle-class workers, and so to do that, I have to essentially screw over, he wouldn't use those words, but this other group of similarly situated workers. Mm. And so it is definitely true that private equity funds benefit public employees. The research is less clear that that is the only way to benefit public employees. And the research is very clear that by benefiting those public employees in this way, all of these other people are also losing out.
Mm. So it's, in other words, it's choosing selectively which groups to pit against each other while still protecting the investments that are being made at the top level, the shareholders, and the value that's being created for shareholders. It's not affecting that pie.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's such a good way of putting it, because in an average year, the investment that a public pension fund has in a private equity firm can go up or can go down. It's the pensioners who are at the most risk. And the private equity firms are just at so little risk.
Mm. You write about how the Toys R Us story really marks this turning point for private equity, away from retail and into other spaces like healthcare and housing. Why is that?
So one big reason is retail just became less of a sexy industry, right? Nobody really wanted to be in retail because of Amazon, because of the pandemic. I mean, that was a huge thing that hurt a lot of retail. Private equity sort of came, saw, and conquered in retail. And now all of a sudden, there were these industries where they were looking and seeing, we can potentially take the same playbook and attach it to all of these industries. So healthcare, for example, is thought to be the ultimate recession-proof industry. People need healthcare regardless of how much money they have. And that makes it super appealing for private equity because the money, to some extent, is always going to be there, right? And so you can see this moment in the late 2010s, early 2020s, where private equity started going really, really hard into healthcare, and in many cases, applying the same strategies that they had previously used in retail.
You write about a hospital in Riverton, Wyoming, where it's a rural area. It was acquired by a private equity firm, and it became clear pretty soon on for the community that this idea of saving the hospital system meant very different things to them versus what it meant to the firm that acquired it. Can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Yeah. So this is in Riverton, Wyoming, which is a town of about 10,000 people. And the character I focus on there, his name's Roger. He's well into his 80s now. And he grew up in Texas, did his first job out of medical school and residency at a fancy suburban hospital in Texas, and decided, you know what, I want to do small town community medicine. Moved to Wyoming, not knowing a soul there, and dedicated his entire life to this community. And he was retired, but on the board of the hospital at the point at which Apollo Global Management bought it. And he knew there were real problems with their hospital financially. He knew that it was struggling. It is very difficult to make money off of a rural hospital, but they duped him in his estimation. You know, they said, we're going to fix it. And instead, they just came in and stripped all the services. So all of a sudden, you couldn't deliver a baby there. You couldn't get a cut stitched up. There was a moment where Apollo's subsidiary company said, the last OBGYN at this hospital has left. It's going to take us a while to replace that person because recruiting at small town hospitals is just hard. And then one night, a friend of Roger's at the hospital found this PowerPoint that made clear that for years they had been intending to get rid of labor and delivery at the hospital permanently. And they had just been lying about their intention to bring it back ever. And so for Roger, that was the lowest point. That showed that not only were they losing all of these services that the community relied on, but also it was a specific plan to do so. And it was a plan that was lining the private equity firm's pockets at the expense of the people in this community who had no other options.
And I know that you continue to follow Roger's story and the way that he organized in his community to essentially fund and build their own hospital to bring back much needed services. What does that say about what is needed and how those needs are being met?
Yeah, so Roger and a group of his neighbors had originally formed a committee they called Save Our Riverton Hospital. And then once they realized they had been lied to and that nobody was going to listen to them, they switched tactics and they said, okay, well, what if we can raise money to build a new hospital? And I think everybody thought they were pretty naive. That's a pretty crazy idea in a small town that, by some definitions, already has a functioning hospital, right? It's not doing a lot, but it has a hospital. And this is a town of 10,000 people. And what happened was they raised almost $60 million. That included the largest USDA grant in the history of Wyoming. And in December, they broke ground on a new hospital. So they will have a new community-owned nonprofit hospital.
I mean, it's really a stunning story in all the ways that you just described. And just to say, you reached out to Apollo Global Management in your reporting, and they referred you to the hospital network called Sage West, who did not respond to you. But one thing I want to point out, Megan, that I really appreciated in your book is, it seems like you really read a lot of economic theory, a lot of foundational materials for this, and you went back to reading Milton Friedman, who was the father of modern-day free market economics, and you point out that even Milton Friedman seemed to recognize that there should be a limit to this kind of thinking when it comes to public services, when it comes to things like hospitals or schools. So why is it that that part of Milton Friedman's original philosophy hasn't seemed to stick around through the current era of private equity that we're seeing right now?
I mean, I wish I knew the answer to that, because my impression of Milton Friedman was, yeah, unchecked capitalism was exactly what he wanted, right?
Right, right.
And so when I first went to his seminal New York Times essay outlining shareholder value theory, and I read the line that there would be exceptions for schools, hospitals, other organizations that serve a charitable purpose, I was stunned. I had no idea that was in there. And nobody talks about that essay as if that line is in there. But I think there's an ease with which people turn a blind eye toward the downstream effects of their actions, right? Private equity is a successful system because it continues to grow. And if you ask any questions beyond that about the costs, I would argue that it shows that private equity is pretty clearly not a successful system. But this is a group of people who are measured on one outcome, and that outcome is how much money did you make last year, and was it more than the year before last?
And by that measure, they're succeeding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're doing great. Yeah.
Let's talk about the current climate in Washington around this. What efforts have been made in the past to try to regulate private equity? And where are those conversations today, as far as you can tell?
So Elizabeth Warren has been the most vocal person on Capitol Hill advocating for serious regulation of private equity. She has introduced several times a bill called the Stop Wall Street Looting Act, originally right after the downfall of Toys R Us, that would fundamentally restructure the way private equity operates. It would be pretty devastating to the industry. As a result, Elizabeth Warren has not gotten a lot of support from her colleagues on this bill. She has had co-sponsors, but not nearly enough to even ever get it out of committee.
Well, just to say, I mean, many federal lawmakers are themselves investors in private equity, right?
Yes, investors in private equity. And the statistic I always tell people that breaks their brains is that 88% of congresspeople and senators receive money from the private equity industry. So
88%.
Correct. On both sides of the aisle.
I mean, how are we supposed to ever expect change to happen if that is the case?
There's not a lot of appetite for it, and it's hard to see without a pretty dramatic change in the composition of Congress. It's pretty hard to imagine any appetite for something like the Warren bill. There is one interesting thing going on now that could have successful results, would not transform the industry the way the Warren bill would. But closing the carried interest loophole, which essentially allows private equity firms to have their proceeds taxed not as normal business income, but as deferred interest that they're not actually collecting now, that then comes with a dramatically lower tax rate. Mm.
This is the carried interest conversation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So closing this carried interest loophole has been a discussion on Capitol Hill for years. Obama wanted to close it. Trump wanted to close it in his first term. Biden wanted to close it. In none of these administrations did it happen because they need Congress and Congress doesn't want to do it. It came really close to happening as part of the American Rescue Plan. And then Kristen Sinema, then a Democrat, succeeded in beating it back. She was also one of the biggest recipients of private equity money. Donald Trump, in his second term, has said, I want to close it. And he has said this several times. And Donald Trump's unique stranglehold on the Republican Party has some folks wondering, is this actually going to be the time? Because if Trump is really serious about wanting this and committed to it in the long term, I suspect some Republicans are going to fall in line and risk ticking off the private equity industry rather than risking ticking off Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing President Trump talk about this for such a long time. And he's always painted this as a fairness issue. Well,
yes.
It's just not fair, which I think is very appealing to a lot of regular people, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Totally. I think private equity is not an issue that has a clear Democrat-Republican divide, which is part of what was really interesting about it to me. The community I wrote about in Wyoming is deep, deep red, and they're furious at these private equity firms, in part because it's an elitism thing, right? These are companies based in gleaming office towers in New York City, and they're a small town in Wyoming, but they see it as a fairness issue. And I think Donald Trump is exactly correct to sense that among many of his voters and say, okay, maybe this is an area where I win some hearts and minds, even if Donald Trump is, on the whole, pretty friendly to big finance.
You know, another thing that I appreciated about the people that you talk about in the book is that they all started from a place of really not knowing much at all about private equity. And we learn alongside them how it works. And I appreciated that it wasn't about the fact that, oh, they didn't know. Why didn't they already know this? The fact is, there's a lot that is hidden from view. There is a lot that is not able to be known because it's not required to be made publicly known.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, the private in private equity refers to the system of capital, but it's also a really nice way of describing the fact that private equity doesn't have to disclose much of anything. And going back to the point about free market capitalism, this is a thing I think about a lot because textbook free market capitalism requires an equal exchange of information.
Yeah, it assumes that everyone has the same access to information, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And workers then have power over their employers because they can make different choices. But in private equity, the workers don't have information, much less the community at large. And so I think there's a serious argument that this is actually a bastardization of free market capitalism because that fundamental tentpole of how it's supposed to work is being compromised. And so I do want to pierce that shield a little bit and give people the feeling that they have the tools to figure it out for themselves, too.
Megan, this was fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
You can read Bad Company, Private Equity, and the Death of the American Dream by Megan Greenwell on Apple Books. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the Apple News app, we've got an excerpt from the book queued up to play for you next.